So to my far left, we have Samantha Kennison. And before I do that, actually, I should probably say a little bit more about what's going to happen tonight. The topic, as you know, is religious responses to suffering. And so we have given each of the panelists a number of questions to respond to, and they've each written about a 6 to 8 minute response to the first two questions. So each student is individually going to give their piece, and then after that, we will pose the other two questions, which they have seen prior to tonight, but they will be able to kind of dialogue with each other more at that point. So the first panelist is our atheist representative. Her name is Samantha Kennison. She's a junior LPS major with a philosophy minor. And next to Sam, we have Chloe Ginsberg, who is our Jewish representative. She's a junior environmental policy and politics double major. Next to Chloe is Joshua Jun. Am I saying that right? Jun. Okay. He's our Buddhist representative, and he is our only non-junior on the panel. Sorry, Josh. And he is a psychology major with a neuroscience minor. On my right, we have Sumit Sen, who's our Hindu representative. And Sumit is a junior, also LPS major, and advertising account management. Next to Sumit is Erin Shoup. She is also a junior. And Erin is a law, politics, and society major as well. So I think we're a little biased in that direction, too. I'm sorry about that. And finally, next to Erin is Nash Albedarin. Am I saying that right? Okay. He's our Muslim representative. Oh, and I forgot to say that Erin is our Christian representative. Nash will be representing his perspectives on Islam, and he's a P1 pharmacy major. So I'll go ahead and read the two questions that we had the panelists respond to, and then we'll start with Sam and move to the right, I suppose. So the first question is as follows. Human suffering can range from physical pain to social injustice to emotional heartache to death itself. What sorts of explanations of suffering have you seen offered in your religion, and which of these explanations do you find personally most plausible? The second question goes a little bit further and says, how does your religion's explanation of suffering empower responses to alleviate it? What sorts of responses to suffering have you seen enacted in your religion, and which of these responses do you personally find most appropriate and helpful? So without further ado, we'll get started with Sam.
Hi. Well, first off, I'd like to start by saying that every atheist is different, so I can't speak for everyone by any means. Everybody has different philosophies and ideas about what the cause of suffering is. But basically, a common theme, and what I personally believe, is that suffering has a cause somewhere. We might not know the exact cause right now or be able to stop it or know a solution, but whether it is disease, violence, or natural disasters, or depression, or something else, we can help one another. We can strive for that cure. We can raise awareness, look for prevention, or help alleviate it by doing good work or by being there for one another. The question isn't always, why does suffering exist, but rather, what is suffering, and what is its cause, and how do we help one another through it? So, kind of a short answer, but that's what I came up with.
So I guess a little bit about my own personal background. For those of you that don't know, Judaism is sort of split among three traditions, the Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox. I was personally brought up in a Reform synagogue with also a lot of experiences in conservative settings and synagogues as well. But because of that, my interpretations of the Jewish tradition is somewhat more liberal than what you might get from other people within the religion. I guess the first of the subjects that I find very personally interesting is sort of how Jewish culture itself has been shaped by our responses to suffering. If you look at the sort of origins of Judaism, a lot of ancient... Sorry, I have a cold, so I'm talking really quietly right now. But ancient Judaism was very centered on traditions and rituals that took place within the temple. It was a very centered religion that was very much tied to a place. However, after the destruction of the first and second temples, the Jewish diaspora, between all of those events, Judaism had to learn to cope with a more decentralized religion. And within that, new structures arose and traditions had to be somewhat adapted. So as the religion was modified, it was at that point that synagogues became more evolved as decentralized centers of religion. And also the religion focused more on something that was no longer something to, that had was tied to a place and was more something that could take place in your home. And that was one of the major responses to that suffering that Judaism encountered. And then sort of jumping forward many, many years, obviously the next critical point in Judaism's history was the Holocaust. And the events of that led many Jews to question their relationship with God and sort of question how Judaism did see the role of suffering in their religion. And although many Jews were conflicted in the religious sense, culturally Judaism became stronger in that sense. With the creation of Israel, which was in part justified by the fact that that could be once again more of a place for Judaism to be tied to, where Jews could escape suffering, sort of that sense of security has presented new challenges to the religion that haven't necessarily been, that are new to both theologists and scholars. In addition to that, there's also more abstract issues when it comes to sort of the afterlife, and Judaism does not offer quite as much of a concrete narrative as far as what happens after death. It's much more of an open-ended question in that we do not say that there is a definitive destination, and it is something that scholars will say we do not know. So therefore, one major issue that scholars and theologists alike will wrestle with is, on the one hand, because fear of the afterlife isn't something that is necessarily there, it's more, it also sort of raises the question of people that have been the ones causing suffering, what happens to them as well, and it's sort of a dual issue that has been brought up and is definitely something that people still wrestle with. I guess sort of as a final note then, as far as a very concrete response to suffering is the idea of tikkun olam. Tikkun olam very much translates to repairing the world, and that sort of embodies the notions of social action and community service, and that is an idea that has become very central to modern Judaism in particular, and sort of bettering the world through small actions that do add up to making the world a better place for future generations with less suffering. And I guess that's where I will leave off.
I'm coming from a, I'm representing Buddhism, but I'm coming from a direction in which I don't follow Buddhism as a religion. My analysis is the result of my own observations and empirical thought on the processes and the application of Buddhism and the philosophy of Buddhism towards my own life. So the tenet of Buddhism, they question the idea of suffering. This is the basic idea that kind of encapsulates the purpose of Buddhism. Why do we suffer? What is suffering? The idea is suffering is the result of our perception of reality, of what the world is. And this perception is the result of our ego, the ego itself creates an idea of continuousness of things within the world. So we believe that things are always the same. For example, the sense of I, always continuing throughout time, despite the fact that every moment we're constantly changing. And this is the logical analysis that Buddhism has come up with, is the fact that everything changes, everything is impermanent, and that is the reason why we suffer, because of this impermanence. It's the disparity between our perspective of what the world is as opposed to how the world actually is. So the world is constantly changing. If you think about it at a quantum level, the molecules are always in flux. They're always moving. And the fact that we think it's solid is just the fact that these molecules are condensed in a form that gives it solid shape. Doesn't mean that it's still not changing. Everything goes towards entropy. Now, how they resolve this is there's two things that are very important. One is the action that one imbues in everyday life. But more important than the action is the intent, the mind state. And by changing the mind state, one is able to change the action or the intent of the action, thus changing how we view the world. How this is done through Buddhism, practical method that I've discovered through my own practice itself, is through meditation. Meditation contains a tool in which we can change the habit patterns of the mind in order to change our actions towards more altruistic means. So what happens is, the way they perceive it is, in this world, there are sensations. It's the object, and we receive something such as a sight, a sound, a taste, a touch, a thought, or a feeling. And the body receives this unconsciously. And when it receives it unconsciously, it creates an association with what we have in terms of, this is a bottle, this is water, this is a microphone. But then there's another level on top of that the mind works upon. And that's where the judgment comes into play. Whether or not this is good, whether or not this is bad. And our clinging or aversion to whether or not it's positive or negative results in our suffering. Because we want to either keep it for ourselves or we want to get it away. And the thing is, we think that the pain will be permanent, or that something that we have that's happy, we want to last forever, even though it won't. And that's what causes the suffering, to realize the ignorance, in a sense, of not realizing that these things will always be changing and will never be the same from one moment to one moment. So if we work on the level of realizing and observing the sensations through meditation, we realize that everything that we feel is constantly in flux. And so then our minds no longer cling to the object in terms of our perception of the object, but realize it as the object truly is. And through that, we can balance our mind, keep our minds from becoming attached to the emotional states that belong to the objects, and thus free ourselves from the suffering by realizing and existing within the constant flux of change. And so the two aspects are, one is to cultivate the mind so that one has awareness of their surroundings. And through the awareness, they can cultivate their own actions, and thus the actions embody the awareness of what the truth of reality is. And so through that, we act in truth, as opposed to following and reacting to just emotional states. And thus, through that, we can end the suffering.
I'd like to preface what I say with saying that Hinduism is a very nuanced religion, and my background is that I've grown up in a Bengali family, so the views that I express here are based on how my family brought me up. So Hinduism varies in not only in geographic location in India, but even in a common geographic location, there are different kinds of Hindus. But suffering is very integral to understanding of Hinduism. There are three common symbols for suffering in Hinduism. These are aging, sickness, and death. Hindus believe that the cause of suffering is our desire for sense objects. And one train of thought is the way to alleviate suffering is through the liberation of the mind from these desires. And the only way you can do this is through strict self-discipline. Another train of thought in Hinduism is that the cause for suffering is the actions performed in one's previous birth, so kind of bringing in karma and reincarnation. Hindus believe in reincarnation, so the basic principle of that is what a person is in a continuous cycle of birth, death, and then rebirth. Central to the understanding of this process is the concept of karma. Karma has come to mean both action as well as the effect of the action. It's a universal law of cause and effect. So in simple terms, good actions can earn you positive karma points, while bad actions will get you negative points. And not only action, but also thoughts are taken into this equation. Therefore, in the Hindu's lifetime, he or she may perform several good or bad actions and could have like countless good or bad thoughts. All of these are stored in a sort of spiritual bank account, if you want to say, and the balance of which determines the quality of a person's subsequent rebirth. So if a person is horrible in his lifetime, he or she will face the consequences of these bad actions or thoughts in his or her rebirth. So contrary to popular belief, karma does not make one fatalistic. In fact, it makes one more responsible towards himself or herself and his or her spiritual welfare. So one can say that Hinduism's explanation of suffering empowers its believers to alleviate it by making them responsible for their own suffering. Since Hinduism proposes that suffering is caused by one's bad karma, it gives believers the agency to actively change their fate. It gives believers the composure to accept his or her suffering with resignation as well. Also, it gives believers the opportunity to redeem themselves through selfless actions. Responses to suffering involve surrendering oneself to God through devotion. However, this is also a very simplistic understanding of the Hindu philosophy. There is also another train of thought which is more deep, and this goes into the fact that Hinduism does not seek to answer why suffering exists, but provides two approaches to deal with suffering. The first approach to deal with suffering is the concept of lila, and a lila basically means play, and it encourages believers to consider suffering and happiness to be a part of the play of God. So just like in a play, it can be only interesting if there's a mixture of pleasure and pain, and laughter and tears. So suffering is part of the play of God, and thus it helps one to understand suffering in a form of perspective and essentially cope with it. Another approach provided by Hinduism to cope with suffering is the concept of Maya. And according to this concept, both pleasure and pain are relative. That is, one cannot exist without the other. So it's like the two sides of a coin. So suffering gives meaning to happiness and therefore is essential to our lives. Again, this concept does not seek to remove suffering, but just provides believers with coping mechanisms to help them accept suffering. So just to end, I'd say that Hinduism does not seek to answer the reasons for suffering's existence. It teaches us how to live with suffering, and a resolution to suffering only comes with union with God. And thus the only endearing aspect to suffering is that it nudges us to seek a resolution to the human condition.
Okay. I'm going to be talking about Christianity. I'm kind of leaning more towards agnosticism right now, but I have learned a lot about Christianity, and I appreciate it a lot, so I'm still really glad to be able to talk about it. So I think a lot of you, since we're in Iowa, probably know something about Christianity already, but just to review, Christianity has a very strong focus on suffering because of Jesus, from being basically sent to earth to die on a cross. There's a lot of, not only that, but being sent to hell for 3 days, his whole point was to suffer, so it's there's suffering in that aspect. But more of what I want to talk about is, first, the explanation of suffering, which is, first, to point out suffering itself isn't considered holy. Like, suffering, when you suffer, it's not just a good thing in and of itself. But there are several explanations for why suffering happens. First is that humans are depending on themselves and not on God. It's human foolishness turning away from God. And then this is kind of related or the same thing. It's the devil's infiltration of the world. And you might not ask, but you might. Why is God not stopping the devil? And then you would think because of free will. And so suffering has to happen. And then another reason that suffering can happen is because God is sending an attention getter to help bring his followers closer to him. And it's used as a message because when suffering, they look for guidance or solace. And so God would hope that they look to him. And it's considered a kindness by God because if you have hope to turn to God, then you can deal with only worldly suffering instead of eternal suffering in hell. So that's good. And then you can transform into a more godly person, and it can give you a better life in the long run. Suffering can. So that's also a good thing. You can learn a lot from it. And then the thing that is most plausible to me, the thing that relates most to me, is that you can learn from suffering, because to me this works in any situation, in any religion, anywhere you are. You can take it, suffering, which is not necessarily good, and turn it into something that would give you a better life in the long run. And then how to answer this in Christianity, or like how to fix suffering, I guess. Basically, all of the questions have the same answer. You're supposed to look to God. So it says in the Bible that God won't put anyone through anything that they can't handle. So, and then it's repeated over and over, God's loving, he's kind. He'll always forgive sins. So God doesn't want people to suffer, and he'll help you if you're suffering, if you try and come closer to him. Because suffering is either people being misled by the devil or God's message to turn to him, you can basically do the same things in both situations. You could pray, is the most common thing, worship, like go to church, stuff like that, read the Bible. That would do, maybe not end it, but make the suffering make sense, something. And then other responses, turn to other godly people, try to change your life to better fit a godly life. And then out of these, what do I find most useful? The Bible, first of all, even though I might not be that Christian right now, it still has a lot of uplifting verses that are still really helpful. And then the most helpful thing, I think, is learning about religion in general, doing stuff like this, I don't know. But it's speaking to people about their views and ideas and how to deal with suffering and what they think about how to alleviate it. And I think that that helps a lot in getting a bit bigger picture of suffering and why it happens.
Okay, so I'm doing Islam today, and I'm doing the perspective on Islam because I used to be, but now I'm agnostic as well. And let's see. Similar to Christianity, suffering is kind of allowed by, I'm not going to say Allah, I'm just going to say God, if that's okay with everyone. Because it's the same word. So similar to Christianity, God allows suffering because God is just trying to pull us closer to him, is the kind of overarching idea in Islam. But it is different in that suffering is framed more as a test from God. The bigger the test, the more someone can prove to God that they are a good person and that they can get closer to heaven, which is the complete goal. In this, suffering is kind of a blessing in disguise. It allows one to be seen much more kindly by God and to have more rewards in the afterlife. But there's another way to look at it, and that's that suffering is a purification process. And thus, by the end of one's life, one will be pure enough to go to heaven. And suffering is also a reminder to Muslims to look at those who are worse off than themselves. And one of the five pillars of Islam is called zakat, which is to help the poor or less fortunate than yourself. And someone cannot appreciate being healthy until they're sick. Another example is that you can't really know what it's like to be less fortunate until you've fasted, which is the month of Ramadan. And that's another reason, is that we do this on a daily basis and we try and appreciate the suffering of other people. We try and get closer to that just so we can realize how well we're doing and how well we can realize the suffering that's going on and how fortunate we are and how much of a struggle it is for other people. And for me, personally, the one thing that I see most plausible for suffering is that it seems to be a test from God or a way to make us better people. And I think that when we take suffering and use it as a lesson, it is the best way we can look at suffering and have it make sense. Because God is always trying to better us and He's never meaningless. And let's go. And my answer to being alleviated, I think suffering can be alleviated in several ways. If one sees suffering as a reminder to help the less fortunate, one would work harder to give the poor money or even just help a friend through hard times. Along with this, one could also fast, as I told you, during the month of Ramadan to better understand what the less fortunate go through. And if one sees suffering as a purification process, one would work to take each moment of suffering and turn it into a positive within oneself. Say someone is having financial difficulty. It would be good to take the difficulty and turn it into opportunity to work harder on the job, or work harder to find a job, get more education, or even go back to school. Then, when the money finally comes easily, the person would remember to go give some back, which is the fifth pillar of Islam, which is zakat. And also, if suffering is a test by God, similar to the purification process explanation, then it would be best to turn to a mosque to pray, turn to a Quran or an imam to speak to someone who knows more about Islam, or an example is another parent that you could talk to. And you do all of this just to get closer to God. And you can also learn about the five pillars of Islam and learn more about it and just start learning about the Quran and reading the Hadith to get closer to God. And all of this would end up giving you the comfort to the sufferer and bring them closer to heaven in the afterlife. And for me personally, suffering is more complex than any of these explanations or all of them combined. It is very, very difficult to explain suffering, especially while the suffering is taking place. And to add to that, there are so many levels and kinds of suffering, it's sometimes a bit difficult to lump it into one large category or determine what suffering actually is. Like, am I even suffering when I miss my favorite TV show for slow traffic? Or when my sister infers that I'm fat? Or when I bite my lip? However, I do think that suffering is something that should remind us of how good things often are, because this leads us to a happier, more compassionate life.
Give the panelists a round of applause. Great responses. I appreciate the thought you put into those. So this part of the dialogue is hopefully going to be very interactive, and we would love for you guys to ask each other questions and really delve into each other's responses. But the first question I'll pose to get things rolling is, after listening to each other's responses, where do you see striking similarities and differences between your responses? And I'll let anyone start. Oh. Is this one okay?
You really
got
it.
Okay. Will do. Is there anyone that would like to start it off?
I'll start off. Should I do this because it's easier? Okay, so I guess for Sumit, I realized when you were talking about, I guess the checks and balances, the positive and negatives, that's pretty much the same thing as in Islam. You kind of deal with the same thing. You work hard and God tests you for the positives, and anything that you do that's wrong is kind of a negative. And in the end, when you go up to like the gates of heaven or whatever it is, it's kind of the same thing. Like, you check and balance, and if you have more positives, you go to heaven. If you have more negatives, you go to hell. So I just thought that was really cool that we had the same similarities about the suffering thing.
All right. this isn't really something that I emphasized in my answer. I actually forgot to leave out a lot of what I meant to say to answer the second question, but I'll try to get more to that with my answers. All right, well, for me personally, I found a lot of similarities between, well, my version of atheism anyways, and Buddhism. I actually had put in my answer that something that helped me deal with suffering, or to at least see like the positive in life and to stay positive, was to look at life as something that is never permanent. It's also something that's constantly changing. So if I'm like having a bad day or something, like it's going to be different tomorrow. And also, well, this is slightly different from Buddhism, but just that the idea that this is the only life we have. So we really just have to appreciate every moment and kind of stay in the present, and not waste our life thinking about the past too much or like the future, but like always having an eye towards like both of them so that we can learn from our experiences and plan ahead. But really life is about appreciating the present, and, you know, appreciating those around us. Joshua, do you have anything to add to that?
I like the fact that she brought up Sam brought up living in the present moment. That's a very important concept in the idea of Buddhism, just because if one finds himself living in thinking about the past or thinking about the future, those are mental constructs that aren't necessarily the real world. And so in order to fully experience the moment, one has to remove themselves from thinking about the past or the future, and live fully in the moment of now. And when you do that, it's almost like your full emotional state, your full physical being is invested in that present time period. And because of that, it gives you a connection to the experience that you're having that is 100% like your being invested into it. And through that, it enables you to feel almost like a sympathetic joy for the experience that you're being given through life. So I much appreciated the comment.
Well, like I said, I actually had it in my answer before knowing that you were going to talk about it.
Well, I just wanted to jump in and say, just bring out kind of a difference that I noticed right now, like with Buddhism and Hinduism. Like for a lot of Hindus, like, past life regression is something they're very into, in which you meditate to and focus all your energy into thinking about who you were in the past and what brought you to this present moment. So we delve a lot in like who we were in our past lives to understand and appreciate who we are right now. So I thought that was like a striking difference.
That question, how does one use that to resolve current situations?
A lot of people who do this past life regression, I know my mother went to one or two sessions of it, and she told me like she felt like she found a lot of answers to questions she had in the present, which she didn't know the answers to. And meditating and like going back into her past life, she kind of found those answers from the past. So that's how I would answer that question.
Gave her tools for application towards her current life.
It was like a more of an emotional upheaval. Like she might have had like these anxieties towards this one person, and she wouldn't know like why she had them. And like the tools that past life transgression gave her helped her to cope with those and understand that it wasn't just like she inherently hated that person, but it might have been something in the past life that person might have like faulted her or done something bad to her for her to have those animosities.
Yeah, we have something. There's something interesting in Buddhism that also resolves that same thing. It's called a kalapa. It's the result of when you're meditating, things arise within you. They could be emotional states, memories, past events, future events, who knows what they are. Thoughts pass through your mind, you feel things. And it's your body's response to trying to I guess, reabsorb or solve a situation that may have been causing some sort of conflict within the body or within the mind. So there is a similarity there.
I just have a question for Chloe. Yeah. I'm just wondering, in regards to Christianity versus Judaism and the fact that Judaism doesn't have the New Testament, how does that affect the way that Judaism answers suffering without Jesus involved? How's the answer come about?
I believe there certainly are a lot of differences very much due to that fact. Suffering for Judaism, also because we differ so much in how we view the afterlife, I think that is sort of one of the main points at which there's a major difference. There's a lot less of, I think, a focus on sort of the, sort of punishment and, like, enacting suffering. There's also less of a focus on the fact that people need to go through suffering in order to reach that point, or that I guess the religion as a whole does. There's certainly a lot of, this is definitely a topic where there's a lot of varying issues ranging from sort of different sects of Judaism, and certainly an Orthodox Jew would answer this question very differently than I. However, the way that I see Judaism is very much less focused on that aspect and much more focused on, I guess, action sort of in the present to alleviate, I guess, is more the direction in which I believe Judaism takes it.
Something that I noticed in a few of your responses was that you've kind of found a tendency towards agnosticism or a slight rejection of the faith that you were brought up in. I think Joshua and Aaron and Nash, you all kind of leaned up in that direction. And I'm curious if you guys still use the responses that you find in the religions that you were raised in to suffering, even though in general you find yourself trending away from that.
Okay. Yeah, I think I do at least. It's hard to get rid of. I don't want to say that. It's hard to like lose all of your religion, and it's not something I would ever want to do, because even if I don't believe everything in it, there's still a lot it can help you with. And like I said in my the answer, I guess. The Bible can still help a lot with the verses it has and the way that it makes you look at things, and like everything has a reason. And even if I'm not quite sure what that is, Christianity has a really nice uplifting message about that. And like Jesus, who died and rose from the grave, it's, I might not believe it, but it's still something that's always going to be with you, that's kind of inherently like there and a good message about suffering, I guess. So yeah, I'm really glad that I have my religion that I grew up with.
Let's see. I don't have a good answer like that. I don't actually believe in Islam that well anymore, so everything that I wrote down I really don't believe in. The only thing I believe in is that there's a God out there somewhere, and that with the only suffering that happens is just kind of by turn of events. There's nothing really, like, I don't know, there's not really anything that we appease him for, and there's not anything that we like do for him. So my real answer to suffering would just be like, it's a turn of events that happens and we just have to deal with it. And the fact is that we just get on with life and we end up going somewhere when we die, and that's with God. But suffering? No, suffering's not a good thing. Suffering's always bad. I guess, yeah, you can learn from it, but I mean, it's still a bad thing initially, but it's always a good learning tool. But it's nothing, I think, like, I don't know, it's nothing godly, it's nothing God created. It's just a turn of events. It's like naturistic, it's like a wind blowing, it's just something that always happens.
Do you observe Ramadan, if I may ask?
Yeah, I do, but for my parents. Yeah.
So Buddhism has a saying. The saying is, all paths lead to the same mountaintop. And in terms of religion, I find that to be very true. Just because it seems every religion has a truth to it, though the truth itself is a partial truth and not an absolute truth, because it's looking at it from one direction. And so if you take all the different types of religious views and use it to understand the similarities between them, you're able to see the subject at hand through multiple directions, multiple perspectives. And it's like looking at a surface which looks like a square from one direction, but if you look at it from multiple sides, you realize it's a cube. And that's kind of how I see the truth of what religion can provide in terms of human life. So do I believe in a God? I believe that there could be an entity that could be considered a God, or some sort of energy or force in this world that we can conceive as being God, though is it a personal God? That would depend on the person themselves. I think God itself is a personal relationship that we have in communion with some sort of relationship with nature and the world around us. And in that sense, I find a lot of the rituals of religion kind of dogmatic, just because at times it wants to cultivate, or people fall into what's called blind faith, as opposed to critically analyzing what's going on objectively to understand how it applies to their own lives. And through that, I think religion does have a lot of merit, because it teaches one the ideas of morality and compassion towards others, and how to live a life that helps to create positive change in this world. And if you can take that from religion, I think that's the benefit that it can provide.
Thanks, Joshua. Our second question for this round is there anything in particular from some one religion that you think has the potential to enrich the explanations of or responses to suffering in your own religion? And I would assume that this would be one of the religions we're talking about tonight, but I guess it doesn't necessarily have to be.
I just wanted to say one thing. I would like to say that Christianity holds a good story in terms of morality and how to live one's life in terms of Jesus. If you think about him as being the Son of God, one would have to wonder, what does God mean? And in that sense, I would see Jesus as being the embodiment of pure love and compassion towards all beings. And so his sacrifice is a message and a symbolic gesture of how we should act. We should sacrifice ourselves in the sense of selflessly giving to others without expectation. And by doing that, it creates no judgment and no desire to have something in return. So we're not looking for a balance, but we're giving because we just want to give. And by doing that, it causes a change in people's way of thinking and the way they act around one another. It's like if you were to give someone a present and they were not expecting the present, you get filled with joy, but at the same time, they also get filled with joy because it was something unexpected. And that can cause a change in them to return that to other people. So in that sense, I think the story and the purpose of Jesus in Christianity provides a good motif in which to follow life.
I'd just like to say really quickly, that was really interesting. I always think of Jesus now as kind of a metaphor, and a really good way of, he always hung out with like prostitutes and lepers, and he was really accepting. And there's not a lot, even back then, that was something we would judge now as he did something, that we would look at and say that seems backwards. And I think I agree with what you said there, and it's a good way of looking at it, even if you're not Christian.
I think the atheist and secular community in general can learn a lot from kind of like looking at other religions and like learning from them. Like I was saying about Buddhism, like I learned a lot from Buddhism, and I've actually heard the phrase that like Buddhism is where atheists find religion. Like I've heard that before. But we can also look at like Christianity, and we can learn from their community building and kind of create our own close-knit community to help, like, support one another, and that can help atheists and secular people also deal with grief and suffering, just like how a lot of people do turn to religion because of that social aspect. And that was, like, another thing I wanted to talk about a little bit was actually how many, like, organizations have started to try to, like, help people, like, deal with suffering and improve the world on, like, a global level as well as, like, a personal level. So it's, like, not just charity isn't just a religious thing anymore. Like, it's for anybody. Like, anybody can start an organization or join nonprofits, and it can be a completely secular cause. And by, like, kind of connecting with people, you can also alleviate grief and suffering a little bit just by, like, having that social connection. And that's something we can really, like, adopt and learn from other religions and how they're organized.
I thought it was very interesting how in every religion, the cause and the reasons of suffering might be different. But I think everyone touched on the fact of, you know, giving selflessly and the virtue of compassion, and that as a means to alleviating suffering, which I thought was really interesting.
One thing I think is that because Judaism really does push the individual to question their own relationship with God and to sort of wrestle with that theistic question on their own, I do think that Buddhism has a lot of things to offer in that respect, as far as sort of looking to oneself and introspection, as far as, you know, working to better themselves and better the world through those thoughts and actions. And I think that that is something that there definitely is room for in Judaism.
I also wanted to make a comment about Islam. I have a friend that is non-practicing. He used to be devout Islam, devout Muslim. Though he still practices and he still goes to regular meetings, discourses and such. Though he did mention one thing, and you did as well, that I find quite a useful tool in terms of cultivating one's own self, and that's Ramadan. The idea of fasting is such an interesting topic to me, just because it teaches you to try to maintain a balance within your own life and yourself, and not trying to get caught up in getting overly desensitized through just experience. And so it's like teaching self-control and learning to grow in intentional action and taking action within your own life in a means that kind of, so you don't get swayed. And I like that aspect. Like, the practical aspect of Islam is very useful.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. I actually fasted this year, like Sumit pointed out. I fasted for Ramadan this year, and it was the first year, I guess, where I wasn't praying, I wasn't doing all the rituals and all that. But halfway through, I kind of realized, like, why am I doing this? And I kind of went to the same conclusion you did of, like, you don't have to be a practicing Muslim to appreciate Ramadan. You have to, like, realize, you need to realize that fasting is kind of more of a tool used to bring you closer to God, bring you closer to your family, and bring you closer to everyone around you. It's kind of a month where you're devoted to kind of just not yourself. Usually we always think about ourselves, but it's the one month where you don't think about yourself. You think about everyone else besides you for a month. And whether you're Muslim, whether you're Christian, it doesn't matter. Everyone can have that, like, selfless act. And that's the one interesting thing I realized when I was going through it, is that I might not believe in the religion as well as I used to, but I can still practice it and get closer to God or whatever it is right now.
Thank you guys very much. So the final part of our evening is going to be a question and answer portion. So is there anyone who has a question they'd like to ask one or several of the panelists? Devon? Right. I'll bring you the microphone, actually, so we can catch it on the recording.
This is more of a general question for all of you, actually, I suppose. When you take an example of suffering, a mass example, such as, you know, the Nazis in their complete hatred and what they did to the Jews in World War II. Obviously, this isn't just for Judaism. But when you look at suffering on a mass scale like that, in terms of the millions of people that were affected and experienced by that, what happened with a lot of people in World War II was they kind of lost hope and faith in humanity. How would you think your religion or perspective on life would sort of restore faith in the world after those kinds of events happen?
I suppose I can start with that. I guess I should maybe clarify. I think it was very much, when I think I was talking about sort of a generation that was very conflicted, and I think that that was an important part of Judaism's evolution over the past 100 years. However, I think that in the case of Judaism, because that has been more or less a repeated experience over the course of Judaism as a whole, I think that part of the way that our religion has coped with that is by looking back to our history and sort of thinking about how to cope with that particular instance in that manner. But certainly it has, I think, in recent years, it's been something that's been more and more talked about, is sort of cultural Judaism as somewhat apart from religion. One of the things, I actually spent a summer in Israel, and having no family there, one of the things I found the most interesting was that many people will say that they are very strongly culturally Jewish, and they have been raised with all of the traditions and the practices that someone in the United States would say makes them a very devout Jew. However, there, for many people, that's considered more of a cultural action. And I think that that sort of separation and distinction has been a way that Judaism has sort of responded to that instance of suffering.
For Hinduism, I can say that, at least for me, what makes sense is if you go back to the two concepts of Leela and Maya, in which these were horrendous acts which questioned humanity. But it also, if you think about it in another light, it also gives meaning to smaller acts of compassion that restores faith in humanity. So I'm not justifying the Holocaust by any means, but I'm just the way Hinduism could try and make its believers reconcile with this mass human lack of compassion would be through emphasizing the smaller gooder, like the heroes that arose from the World War II, the people who did do whatever they could to help, you know, the innocent. So that's my understanding.
I guess the way that someone would explain it, if they were a Muslim trying to explain why that suffering was going on and how to raise the hopes of people, it's that you would say that the people who died and the people who are suffering, in a Muslim perspective, would all be going to heaven, and that's their paradise because they had hell on earth, so they go to paradise. And that's kind of where all the suffering and all the sufferers go. And that would hopefully raise the hopes of all the people who were involved in it. But I don't know. It's a tough one. I guess also what a Muslim would say is that you should read the Quran. And that's filled with hope, even though people don't think of it. But it's filled with hope everywhere. And it's just in the fact that if you do good, and if you're a sufferer, you read it, and you realize that you are doing good and that you're the underdog, and that's all you can be, then eventually you'll be led to your paradise.
For many people, it's events like the Holocaust and other like violence and suffering that goes on in the world, like wide scale, that leads people to question if there really could be like a God at all, or at least just a loving God. That was an experience I went through personally, because I've been an atheist since I was like a little kid. One way a lot of people look at these things, instead of focusing on like how like, well, basically what they focus on is how we can prevent it from happening in the future, or like how we can do to improve the lives of people who suffer through these things, and they realize that it is completely up to humanity to help humanity through these tragedies.
So I guess in Buddhism, they would say that it's something that's inevitable. Suffering is going to occur, regardless if it's in a large scale or a small scale, the individual or a group. There's a story in which there was a woman, and she had a child, and the child died, and she was sad, and everyone was telling her that the child was dead, but she didn't believe anyone. She was adamant that it was alive, and she's like, no, it's not. It's just sick. It's not waking up. It's asleep. And so someone mentioned to her, well, go see the Buddha. Maybe he can help you. This is the historical Buddha. And so she went to him, and she said, can you help me? My child's not waking up. And he realized the child was dead, but that she was in such an emotional state that she wouldn't understand his answer of letting go and, you know, releasing this emotion that she has attachment to this child that passed away. So he told her, okay, what I can do for you is, if you can go and bring me some sesame seeds from a family, I bring them back to me, and I can bring your child back to life. And so she said, okay. And he said, wait, before you go, you have to get the seeds from a family in which no one in their household has ever died. And so she went across town, and she kept asking people, like, can you give me some sesame seeds? And yes, I can, but wait, has anyone died in your family? And everyone, yes, my mother died, my father passed away, I had a nephew that passed away, a son passed away. And she kept going house to house. And through that, she realized that death is inevitable. Everyone dies. And it's something that occurs, and it's just our attachment that creates the suffering that we attach to the death. And is the action itself bad in the perspective as we view it? Yes, perhaps it is. But it occurred. And because it occurs, we shouldn't be attached to the event as its history. We should move forward. And what we should do is act in a way so it doesn't happen again. And so I guess Buddhism would indicate, instead of thinking about how we can remedy the past, we can meditate and focus upon ourselves so that we don't get attached to those things emotionally, and act in a balanced state of mind so that we treat everyone equally and with compassion in our hearts.
Those are wonderful answers.
Does anyone else have a question they'd like to ask?
Okay.
Just for the sake of the recording, I'm going to repeat the crux of that question, which was, how do you find peace without a religion to turn to in times of suffering?
This is a question that atheists get a lot, because like a lot of people have trouble understanding how we can find peace and comfort, especially when like a loved one dies or something like bad like that happens. But really, for a lot of people, we can find peace in the fact that like we had the opportunity to have that person in our lives, and that we are able to grow from the experience of knowing that person,
or we find peace in the fact that we just had the opportunity to have a good life at all, or to live at all. Basically just that, like, we don't really have to look for a higher power to give us, like, meaning to our lives. We can find that meaning ourselves. We can find it in how we interact with one another, or we can find purpose in our life by doing what we really love or by helping others. And we don't have to leave it up to, like, a church to tell us what we should be doing with our lives or something like that. We can, like, find our own purpose because there isn't anything limiting us. So a lot of people find peace in that.
Is there anyone that would like to respond to that? You don't have to.
Any other questions from the audience?
Seeing none,
I'd like to thank all of the panelists wholeheartedly for speaking to us so candidly tonight, and I thought that there was some really great dialogue that happened, and thank you all for giving up your nights to come and hear what these guys had to say, and I would also like to encourage you all to come to the next event in the Comparison Project series, which is the lecture by the Sikh scholar, and I don't know the date of the event right off the top of my head. September 27th, and I believe it is here again. Harvey Ingham 104 at 7 o'clock.
Nikki Chin, professor of religious studies at Colby College in Maine, is going to speak on Sikhism and suffering, understanding and healing after the Milwaukee massacre. I believe that's the subtitle of the lecture. She's a dynamic speaker. She's written many books. We'll be promoting this over the next few weeks. And hope to see you there. Thanks for coming out to our first event. We'll find her right here. We'll find her way with food too.
I think there's some Saran wrap left if you want to put it in that to wrap it up.
Thanks again to the panelists and to Dora.
Christianity, like every religion claims it's right, and you learn more about other religions than you learn it.
Yeah, that's the thing. I never liked it. There's only one.
Yeah,
we'll be sure.
I could talk for hours if you guys want.
It'd be nice.